Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AHTT. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Hard to Tell Podcast, episode 124. Dex Emery, Brian Fonseca here. We got a Boricua in the building.
Oh, yeah. I was wearing Ridgewood. My hat for people listening.
Wearing you a hat. Know what's up. You saw that hat. It was on Sideline Stories. See the Sideline Stories t-shirt. You saw the hat. It was on La Cultura episode of Sideline Stories. Really good. Coming up, we got some things coming up around that. So you should see. Also, for people who need to know, latest episode of Sideline Stories came out last week. You should check that out. It's about how sports journalists are dealing with things during COVID-19. But we are here during COVID-19, quarantining, being safe, unlike some states in the South. And I spoke to some people in Georgia yesterday. Woo! Yo, people out there, like, it's... Brian, they're out there like nothing ever happened.
Have cases gone up yet?
Nah, there aren't really any numbers in that. I think it's going to take about a week or so before we start seeing that. But... okay. I saw some video. I talked to my cousin who's a doctor down in Georgia, and she was telling me about how people are just out on the streets like nothing ever happened. Another friend of mine who's a doctor, I was speaking with his wife yesterday. She wished me a happy birthday and was talking about how there's stuff like that out there too. So crazy, man. Crazy
not
stuff.
Not time yet, man. It's not time for that stuff.
And we're going to get into that with sports because Brian said it's not time. Before we get to that, Brian, first of all, how are you doing with quarantine life? How's quarantine life treating you?
Like I told you, minus the obviously bad parts about this, I'm enjoying this.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm introverted. You know what I mean? Well, if I don't know you, like naturally among strangers, I'm introverted.
Right.
If I know you, I'm very extroverted.
Brian's so introverted, I'm surprised he ever came up and spoke to me.
Yeah, yeah.
He might have not spoken to me.
Yeah, probably not. Like, it just, like, vibes of everything. Like, yeah. In terms of just being able to just do some things creatively, some side projects that is way too early to talk about for me yet, that I'm working towards, and then just, like, this.
I'm rubbing my hands like stuff. You, because we spoke about that. Yeah. We spoke about it, and I'm excited about it. I support
it. It's way too early, but I'm making a little bit of progress every day with it, and we'll see where that goes. Setting that up. But other than that, it's fine, man. Survive in advance like March Madness. That's all you can do right now.
Yo, I like that. That's the motto. I like that. Survive in advance.
Literally what I've been telling myself since this whole thing began. And look, man, here's the thing what people are understanding because people want to like run outside and things like that. Mm-hmm. Like, yo, it can still be worse. So we should actually be grateful for that. Like,
yeah,
and we need to relax before it gets worse.
We really do. And speaking of not relaxing, I'm doing fine and try to take it one day at a time, as Brian said, survive in advance.
Stay fit. Also,
yeah, I've been doing a great job like that. It was a little lazy with the diet my birthday weekend, but I've been doing
the mulligan.
Yeah, I'm fine. I've been working out multiple times a week. I actually have some equipment that I just ordered that's coming in. So I've actually feel like I've been better about my fitness.
What'd you order?
I got some resistance bands, like a whole bunch of resistance bands and stuff.
I needed.
I used to have a whole set of other ones from when I used to personal train, but those are at my dad's house. And so obviously I can't go get those. So I had to order some other stuff. I got that. You know, I got a little ab roller, got doing some body weight exercises. There's a lot of ways. So
there's a lot. Yo, YouTube, they're Anabolic Aliens, Jordan Yo. A lot of people got some good stuff there. I got a couple dumbbells and a kettlebell, so I'm straight. I got medicine ball, too.
I actually want to buy some kettlebells, but me and my best friend, we've been working out about three times a week. We FaceTime each other, pushing each other, and so it's been good. It's been great. Like, we've been doing that. And you know what I do? I do wind sprints in the hallway now, so I do it with my daughter. My daughter, she just wants to run it back and forth in the hallway. So I let her go, and she thinks I'm a catcher, and I just blow past her, and then I just keep doing wind sprints back and forth. So
I do that here, too. I just don't be saying anything.
All right, but some people, we talked about this on a previous podcast, but some people are so desperate to get back to sports, and we've had some news that's come out around that, especially around the NBA. Really interesting stuff. The NBA had stuff that came out a little bit earlier, a couple days ago, saying that they were going to reopen team practice facilities beginning this Friday after when you hear the podcast. For players in states and municipalities, I can never say that right, that are loosening stay-at-home restrictions amid the coronavirus pandemic. This is what sources told ESPN, according to Adrian Wojnarowski. Woj dropped that. So that includes states like Georgia, which we've talked about on this podcast, the last one time for your mind. We spoke about this and our thoughts and how we feel about this. Brian and I talked about this a couple days ago. Brian sent this to me in a text that this would, you know, happen on May 1st. I immediately said I thought it was a bad idea. I think reopening anything.
Woj came out and did say that there's been like there's been some pushback.
Pushback, and I was going to get to that. There has been some pushback to that, to the initial May 1st date. And so there was pushback that said it was coming from players, staff. So it was coming from all corners of the NBA. Yeah. I'm glad there was pushback on this. When I saw that, that did make me happy. I am concerned about this because this is what it comes down to for me, Brian. Doing this doesn't get us any closer to having sports, right? If anything, it could only push us further away. And that's the way I look at it. This does nothing to get us further to sports. So why are we doing this?
I think as they said, as it was said in the report, like the main thing is making sure that players could stay in shape in some way without, you know, in because I saw that, you know, people are worried about now that certain places are opening up little by little, which obviously they probably shouldn't be yet. Our players going to join Equinox? Our players going to join 24-hour fitness? Are they going to come in contact with people at these gyms? Instead, let's open a practice facility and give them a place that is safer for them to do it. In terms of the practice facility stuff itself, I think that there's a way. Let me answer this in two parts. I think that there's a way this can actually be done. If they're saying, like, you know, obviously not too many people in the building, physical distance, one guy lets you open, no more than four people at a time, maybe one at each hoop. You know, there's ways to sort of like, there's ways to sort of do this in a way that's, I guess, safe, right? Now, here's my thing. Is it smart? Is it the smartest way to go about this? Probably not, right? And that's where I'm leaning at. Like, it's possible there's a way that you could do this. Perhaps it can be successful, but no, look at the words I'm using. Perhaps, possibly, maybe. Is it the smartest thing? Probably not. Is it too soon? I would say so. I would like to see. May 1st is just too soon. You need to give me June 1st before I can even think about it. And even then, I need to see what it looks like. You know,
we have had experts, the people everybody should be listening to at this time, medical experts who have said there should not be any reopening of anything to at least at the earliest June 15th. This was said weeks ago.
June 15th, yeah.
And now you've got leagues talking about, well, first of all, I'll say what I said to Brian in the text. I do find the NBA at some fault for even trying to push this and push this out there because, as I said, I don't think this gets us closer to anything that we actually want. Yeah. However, most of this blame falls on the horrible leadership of the governors in these states who actually allowed for this to happen in the first place. Because if you don't have that, then you don't have this. Still, the NBA has to be better and say this isn't good for our people. Brian's right. There might be a way to safely do this. I still think there are too many variables you have to worry about. Where are players going after this? Where are the people who opened up the building going after this? Can they bring it back? Is it really ready for us to do it? The answer to me is really clearly no. I don't think there's any benefit or reward here that's worth doing this. The risk is it's not worth the reward here. The reward's not even that great. Great. You could do this and you can still find out we might not see an NBA season until 2021. So then what?
Yeah. I think their main thing is just trying to figure out ways to just keep guys in shape, keep guys active on their sort of on their watch where, you know, they're people that live in condos that have no access to equipment, hoops, whatever. And I was listening to another podcast that basically said, yo, if you're an NBA player and you don't really have access to these things, that's kind of on you. And in a way, I'm like,
I'm not sure that's so fair.
I don't know if I go that far. Like,
access to a hoop, yes, I think is tough. But access to like working out equipment, I mean, you might have a delay on some stuff, but you can order some working out equipment. And yeah, teams can order these for the players too. Let's be serious. Well,
yeah. First and foremost, yeah, take care of your employers, right? And then there's also two-way players, guys on rookie contracts, which, you know, the league is vastly made up of. I mean, guys even on minimum deals that are veterans and, you know, probably haven't made that much in their careers because they've been playing overseas. Like, you know what I mean? I don't know how Brad Wanamaker's living. Never mind a Devontae Graham who's still on his rookie contract. You know, right. So I don't know what that's sort of looking like. But yeah, I mean, I can't, it's too soon. Like, again, there's probably ways, like, look, you can probably experiment this and it works out, but then what, as you sort of alluded to, and then part of this is also, look, you can probably get away with this in smaller areas. You can probably get away with this in certain cities where teams play or around where their practice facilities are, but the Nets and Knicks can't do this. You know what I mean? Right. If you're in a certain area, like if you're the Lakers and the Clippers, No. You can drive everywhere, but that's going to be a little tougher. If you're the Miami Heat, it's possible, but is it worth the risk? You know what I mean? Like in all these cities,
Florida is always Florida.
Well, yes, valid point. Same thing with Orlando, and you're talking about some of your elite teams when you're mentioning Lakers, Clippers, Celtics, who are in a big city as well, Miami, and things of that nature. So it's just too.
I wish
It's not worth it right now. The upside is not really worth it.
Exactly.
Yet. It's not like we're knocking on the door of really coming to the end of this.
We ain't even at the door. We ain't even at the door. No. We're not at the door. Like, and people need to understand this.
Well, again, what's the door, though? Like,
you know what the door is?
I kind of want to finish the metaphor.
The door is when I see medical experts, again, people, say in a couple weeks, we're ready to start phase one of reopening stuff. That's at the door. That's at the door. We're not even there yet. Nobody's even saying, hey, this is 2 weeks away from the. We're not even there yet.
Yeah. I mean, so, I've said we're not going to be. I've said it's not going to come in May. You know what I mean? I've said to you, even in private, I'm like, the earliest I could see things even opening up is like June 1st. But even then, it would be very, very, very slow and gradual. And I'm thinking of it. I mean, look, Georgia's already doing it. So we could start there. But even then, it's like I'm saying that 2 months ago, not knowing what May is going to look like. So I was just throwing out a date. Look, I'm not a medical expert.
Look, with that being said, people listen to the medical experts. Why are they not the people we're listening to in here? How come nobody?
Because people just want to worry about money.
This is the big question I have for the
NBA. Money's always the answer.
It is the answer. But the question I have for the NBA and all these other leagues, when you're floating this stuff out and you're getting this stuff and Woj is able to report in it, is anybody asking these folks, hey, who did y'all speak to? How did you come to this decision? How did you decide that this is the time you do it? Because the governor, who clearly has made some dumb decisions in Georgia, is saying that's the right thing to do. Like, because when numbers spike, and I do think it's going to happen in Georgia, and I hope it doesn't. I don't want to see people sick. I don't want to see people die. But I just think that they've rushed it too soon. Everything's all good till it happens to your family gets sick, your family member, your loved one gets sick. It's all good for everybody. And we want to rush back to this stuff until more people get hurt. And it shouldn't have to do that. Like, we have to learn from the past. Look at the history of other pandemics. Look at what happened with influenza back in the past
month.
Right. Learn. The thing is, a second wave could come and be more deadly. What we have more information than people did in the early 1900s is that we know that that happened. So let's be proactive. When you're trying to open up these gyms and facilities, you're not being proactive.
Yeah, sorry. I mean, the way that this is going to move is, you know, all the people who are rallying and holding these large gatherings and they want to, you know, open things up and they're in this rush. If like 75% of them get sick and they actually understand how serious this is, then maybe we could start actually making progress. Like being straight up about it. I mean, because those are the people that probably need to get infected for everyone to be like, oh, okay, we're wilding. Let's close back up. Let's restart this again in places like Georgia. At least you and I are in New York, where, I mean, granted, we've been hit the worst, but I'm saying at least we have like leadership that's competent, and we know that we're probably not going to act too soon on certain things.
I don't think that's going to happen here, but I do get concerned for people elsewhere, and it's not just in America. For a perfect segue here, it's also happening overseas, and it happens in the most popular sport in the world. That being the sport, some of us, you know, the rest of the world will call it football. We call it soccer here in the United States. Yeah. But the Bundesliga has a plan to return to action on May 9th, right?
Bundesliga, for people who don't know, is in Germany. German and it's one of the biggest soccer leagues in the world, probably one of the best always. I'm surprised you didn't know about this before I told you about this specific story.
No, I admit, I admit.
You watch some Bundesliga.
I watch some Bundesliga. I'm more of an English Premier League guy. I think that's a big league in the world. But I do watch some Bundesliga, and that's German's top league, set to resume next month behind closed doors. That's if permission is granted by the government. So this is not official yet. Permission has been granted by the government. However, this is Professor Uwe G. Liebert, I hope I'm said your name right, sir, says the league's proposed hygiene measure of games without fans and regular testing and monitoring of players are not sufficient to protect the safety of those involved. I happen to agree with him. I think he's thinking about the fact that they're still way too many factors in this. Yeah. He said, he told, this is the Middle Dutch Zeitung in Germany, we don't know about the long-term effects of an illness with COVID-19. It's possible to get sick or die from the virus at a young age. Quote, you can only detect an infection after 48 hours. From my point of view, all people in contact with a soccer player are first-degree contact, so everyone would have to go in quarantine, possibly also the opposing team. Which I think this scientist is trying to show you how broad of a scope and one person potentially being infected could affect everything and everyone that they come in contact in. And again, this is why I keep saying, Brian, this is not worth the risk, man.
It's not.
It's just not worth the risk.
I agree. I mean, look, it's the same thing with the NBA situation. There are just too many factors. There's just way too many factors for you. Because look at what we're talking about. We're talking about just possibilities at the end of the day. Look at the measures that people are talking about. If we do, like with baseball, for example, we talked about this recently. If we move everybody here and then we isolate them and test them every day and put them in a bubble and maybe do this and keep them away here, isolate them in a hotel. Like, it's too much. Just wait. Just wait. You know what I mean? Like, people are so – the problem is, especially here in America, people are just so worried about, like, money and the economy and stuff like
it's
that.
It's everywhere, too, but yes.
No, but especially here, when, you know, I mean, look, people apparently want to die for that shit. When it's like, look, man, there are just more important things right now.
Well,
like
livelihood. We do have to remember there was a senator down in the great state of Texas that said there are more important things than living.
Yeah. Idiot. But that's what I'm saying. It's like those are the kind of people. All right, then you go. You know what I'm saying? You go to the next phase of this.
Right.
But you know what I mean? Like, leave us on Earth alone.
I'll say this before we move on to the next topic. But there are things that we have to do and adjust in this time. And it does seem like people are having a hard time adjusting. Bundesliga is about 25 games into their season. So they're trying to wrap that up. There are some talks that the EPL is trying to do the same thing, English Premier League. As much as I would like to see my Liverpool Reds get the title this year that they deserve after they were dominating the league so much. Yeah. No, they don't need to come back and play because there's more things important than seeing my Reds hold up the title. I want to see it happen, but you know what? Things are more important than that. Safety first, man. Safety first.
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, I want to see Raheem Sterling again. I want to see the former Liverpooler play again. Yeah, former Liverpool. Yo, I used to use Liverpool that year with him and Daniel Sturridge. I used to kill with them.
I loved
that. It's just too soon for all of this. I mean, at the end of the day, we just have to wait because it just doesn't make. What's the upside here, right? The upside. I mean, look, this past weekend we had boxing in Nicaragua. I can't definitively tell you that, you know, that's going to be like great long term. Like, yeah, the fighters, everybody got paid. I guess they're safe. Nicaragua only had 12 reported cases before this, and they have a population of over 6 million. Do I believe those numbers? I'm not sure. I don't really believe anybody's numbers right now. You know what I mean? But I think some are exaggerated and some less so. But there's just so much we don't know. Like, yo, everybody just sit and just wait this out and listen to the experts and see what they tell us eventually when it's okay to, like, you know, go back to whatever the new normal is going to be.
Yeah. All right, real quick. We had the NFL draft take place last week, and that was interesting in itself. It was all done virtually. I thought the production of it, despite the circumstances that they had, they did a pretty decent job with it. Now, I will be honest with everybody. I only watched about 6 to 7 picks in the first round. I can't watch the NFL draft that long. I don't care that much. The NFL draft is a crapshoot. There's way too much time between the picks, and I just get absolutely disinterested. So I went on to watch something else that probably was better. However, there's a lot of things that went around with the NFL. The two issues. One, there was a lot of people, especially men, who came out and said, this is the first real live sporting event that we've had in, you know, or event around sports in a long time, and totally disregarded the fact
they
that
were so excited.
The WNBA draft had taken place a week before. But forgetting about women, not so common around certain men with certain sensibilities in sports. So I'm not that surprised
about
it. Those
are the theme of this podcast, America. You know what I mean?
not surprised in this country. The WNBA, who did a great job with their draft, in handling it virtually and everything in the production of that. I watched more of that than I did of the NFL draft. They did a great job with that. But Brian, you texted me about something and brought up the fact that in the NFL draft, if you watch this, guys, and Brian, for those who aren't watching this, is rolling his eyes. I think this is a common drafting, but nobody hits on it more than probably the NFL draft. Nobody dives
deep into the
NFL draft. And I want to say, I want to put what Brian wrote in the notes here for this podcast, and he said there's way too much black trauma being shown. I happen to agree.
If you look at me, I'm clearly not black.
No.
So, yeah.
Brian, please explain the black trauma for the people that is shown consistently through the NFL draft.
It'll be like the 14th pick in the NFL draft, and then they'll be like, oh, you know, this is a tackle from – no, let's not use a tackle. Wide receiver from the University of Clemson, 6'2", 208 pounds, physical receiver, has big hands, you know, 62 catches, 1,008 yards, 11 touchdowns, you know, was a big playmaker for Trevor Lawrence. And then they'll play the sad music, and then they'll be like, but his mom – you know, tragically, you know, she used to shoot up heroin for 16 years of her life. And then the father wasn't there. And then they get into the whole shit. And I'm just like, yo, dog, like, even with the thing about it is not even beyond the fact that they're talking about things that they don't really need to talk about in a draft. Like, if Miran Fader is doing a human interest story on this person, I'm here for her uncovering those details. You know what I mean? But if we're just talking about a draft, I don't think people need that human interest stuff there to that degree. You know, tell me that the dude wants to open an auto body repair shop when he's 35 years old. I'll be good with that. I don't need the whole entire sad details that everybody just going to, you know, everybody, largely NFL fans who are, you know, largely white, are going to sit down and look at it and be like, damn, yo, glad that's not me. And then just keep it moving with their draft experience.
That's a fascinating, like, it's a fascinating point you make, that when they, it's not about them doing the human interest stories or that they're bad, but that it always seems to be regurgitated about the same subject. And we don't do anything looking at, hey, what's this guy's goals? What does he want to do beyond football? What kind of person is he? You know what I'm saying? Like, his essence isn't tied to his pain.
Because, like, with me, that's what I actually want to know about these kids. If I'm just a normal consumer, and, you know, I'm a sane sort of sports consumer, I would like to think, I would want to know, like, yeah, what do these kids want to do? Like, I actually want to know, what are their interests outside of football? Mm-hmm. Is this person into cinematography? Does this person like to draw? Does he like to do, like, really cool stuff? Does this person, you know, like, did he save somebody's life before? That'd be cool to know. You know what I mean? But I don't need to know about his worst trauma, especially when you're trafficking on it with a whole production that has music behind it all the time. Because Trey Wingo would change the tone of his voice. The piano will kick in. And then the photos will be black and white, and it'll be sad. It'll be the whole production. He'll change the tone of his voice, and he'll get really serious when he's talking about Nazim Muhammad's worst trauma when he was 16 years old.
The voiceover's
and his father committed suicide with a bow and arrow in the middle of the Grand Canyon. What are we doing?
I'm not trying to laugh at anybody committed suicide. I just want to be clear. I'm laughing at the ridiculousness of how they have to double down on the pain all the time.
Maybe I misheard this, but somebody had a family member that got eaten by a shark or attacked by a shark or something like that. I'm going to have to look this up on Twitter. And they actually talked about that. I'm like, dog, I don't think these are the details we need, especially, look, and let's boil it down to the fundamentals of this. We're talking about a draft, right? These kids in the NFL entering the NFL draft, 20, 21, 22, 23 years old. I don't want to talk about their worst trauma on the night they're getting drafted. So they've been working hard for this for so long. I don't want to get into that now.
So here's the thing. The other side of people are going to say, well, look, there's 10 minutes between picks, as I complained about before. They've got to fill it with something. My thing is, I understand all that.
I don't know what, but you know what? I don't know what anybody majored in.
I understand all that, but my thing is they can be more diverse in the storytelling that they choose to fill it with. I understand that there's also going to be some pain. I don't have a problem with there being some pain, but when that's all you keep selling around these athletes who happen to be black men, it's disappointing. You can find something else. How come we never hear the story about the dude who came from a two-parent household whose parents might have been doing pretty well and they were in academia or whatever they were doing, it could be anything, and they use their stuff from that world to help push them through sports. I know this exists. I'm sure it exists, but we never hear that all the time. And it's like, look, we complain about the same stuff with music and movies and TV shows. Hey, NFL Productions, hey, ESPN, whoever it is, you can be a little bit more diverse. But I'll tell you what, people, if you really want some diverse stories, you don't want any of that, yo, watch Sideline Stories. You might get something sad in there, but we're gonna give you some diversity in the storytelling. You can guarantee that.
Yeah, I mean that's really what it is. It's just I saw that and it jumped out at me like probably about 7-8 picks in, maybe a little more than that, where it happened about 4 or 5 times, and I was like, okay, whatever. And then by the end of the first round, I was kind of like, damn, they did that a lot. And I think Bill Simmons even started his podcast like joking about it because of how often they did it. He's like, who is that for? Like, who are they trying to target there? And I had the same thought. And then it was the next day in the second round where I'm like, wow, they're doing it again with the music and everything. Like, they're not laying off this. And
they already paid people to pre-produce this stuff. They're like not going to not run it.
Here's the thing, too. The reaction was so – a lot of people on Twitter had my same sensibilities. Not that many white people that I saw that had those sensibilities.
I still think there's a lot of people don't care. So I say that, too.
But I think, but overall, I mean, this was my problem when Oprah Winfrey endorsed that story that – the white lady wrote, I forgot, but she says that she's Puerto Rican, but she doesn't really claim whole thing. I forgot the name of the story, but she endorsed it, and a lot of people had problems with it because it's basically a white woman writing about the traumas of black and brown kids. And a lot of people are tired of that. A lot of people that look like you and I are tired of that. I'm tired of basically white people giving out our stories, and they're always traumatic. Well, and it's in a way where it's like, yo, you guys like to traffic off of that stuff. You know, there's a lot of good shit that comes out of our communities, too. A lot of it. Well, it doesn't really get talked about.
I will say this because we got to run and jump to the next segment with a guest we have coming up. But what I will say is a lot of times this happens because there aren't a lot of black and brown faces in positions of producers, executive producers, to make decisions or check the white folks in these positions who are making these decisions. So when you keep having people who look the same making these decisions, and then they got to go into communities where there are black folks telling these stories around it, this is what you're going to get because, unfortunately, there's not anybody to check them. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at www.audibletrial.com/AHTT. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. All right, we're bringing my man Deontay Prince, writer, editor for the Chicago Tribune. And Deontay, what's up, man? Long time no talk. How you been?
I've been good. You know, I made the trip over from New York to Chicago. This is actually a good time to be out here, you know, basketball-wise. So enjoying the move, family here, so everything's well.
Yeah, I was happy for you to be able to get back home. That had to be exciting to just get back home and then also be able to write back and, you know, where you grew up.
Yeah, everything worked out as well as possible. Obviously, like SI layoffs or whatever, but I ended up getting to come home and work at a place that I kind of dreamed of working at, you know, as soon as I started this journalism thing. So it worked out well.
Nah, they're definitely happy about that. Now, part of the reason we had to have you on here, of all people that I know, grew up in Chi-Town. I know you were a Bulls fan growing up. So what was the anticipation like for you for this Last Dance series that we're watching now? How hyped up were you for this?
Yeah, I was hyped from the beginning. The thought was that we would have, you know, we would get through the playoffs and then we would have like this nice thing waiting on us at the end to sort of extend the basketball season. And then obviously when things were pushed back due to coronavirus, the anticipation for this just became so crazy. And when they said that they were gonna, you know, push up the date and everything, I was super excited for, you know, as a basketball fan, just to get to see all of the footage and all the stuff that they recorded over the years. And then, you know, work-wise too, because, you know, we don't have a season to cover right now. And,
right.
You know, this is our bread and butter, you know, Bulls and Michael Jordan and everything. So, you know, this is going to keep me busy for the next, you know, 5 weeks or three at this point. But, yeah.
Yeah.
I was super excited for it.
Yeah, no doubt. We're absolutely loving it. We just got through parts 3 and 4, watching that. What is your takeaway of the series and what you've seen thus far? I mean, we've seen a lot. Is there something really big that stands out to you you've taken away from this?
Well, there are a few things. The Bulls' treatment of players was not great in general. I think we look at this, and because we're taking in the Bulls part of it right now, we're probably not extending it to the rest of the league. I would think outside of Boston and L.A. or you know, Detroit and places like that, that this was sort of like the way things went in a lot of different cities in the NBA. You know, before all of the player empowerment and everything, you know, Jordan had a big hand in that. Magic and Larry had a big hand in that. But I would assume this is the way a lot of basketball stuff worked. You know, Scottie's contract, I think Dennis held out at some point to start that season. Mike was on a bad contract until his last 2 years. So that really jumped out at me. I would say, you know, a lot of the Dennis stories were illuminating.
Yeah.
Him and Scotty, just their background and how they were sort of like plucked out of obscurity as basketball players, you know, like, they were basically adults before they were really basketball players and kind of more athletes than anything. So that, while I knew it, it's different to see the footage and to hear them talk about it. And I guess the Jerry Krause stuff has really been heavy too. So those are the threads that I've been following. The Jordan stuff is sort of like, I know most of it, but it is nice to see how candid he has been in these interviews, even up to last night, where he's like laying all of his feelings about Isaiah and the Pistons out and just like not holding back anything. So it's been really nice just to see everybody, like, they committed to doing this and they really committed, like they really are like all in, and you can tell they're not holding anything back. So that's the good thing, that while it's sort of a little buttoned up, when they actually interview the people, like, they give us everything.
Yeah, they absolutely have.
Are there any points of this that you feel like, because we have nothing else to talk about, that they're being overcovered? Like, we're making too much of this thing or too much of this, of any of those things you mentioned or anything you've seen in these first four parts at all?
Probably, I mean, Jerry Krause, like, the villain angle of Jerry Krause has gotten huge. So there's that. Jordan as a teammate, and we might see a little bit more of that coming soon. There's been a lot of conversations about Jordan as a teammate, you know, calling guys out or maybe being physical with people. But that's sort of how sports are. Even when you're not at the level where you're making millions of dollars, like,
yeah.
I've definitely been in practice where dudes are like playing the play and getting in your way and being disruptive because they want to be starting, and y'all end up getting in fights. Or almost getting in fights. You know?
Oh yeah,
and that
was
high school, so. That's probably been overblown a little bit. And obviously Scottie's contract became a big topic of discussion that after that first week. He went and made a lot of money after he left Chicago, but that first, what was it, 7 years, $18 million, that was the biggest conversation for leading up, even up to last night, everybody was talking about Scotty.
What were your thoughts on that, Deontay, with the contract? Because you heard a lot of people saying his agent did a bad job, blaming him. I think there's a lot of ways you can look at this, right? Like in terms of the fact that he comes from the South, comes from a very impoverished situation, and I kind of understand why he signed that contract. However, he's a grown man, and his owner did tell him not to sign that contract. So it's hard for me to really... I feel bad for Scotty, and don't get me wrong, a lot of players were done wrong, but he did sign that deal.
Well, I'll start with saying that I don't know that I necessarily believe everything that Reinsdorf says about
that's
the
fair.
Way the negotiations
That's
went.
Fair.
That's fair. If he was, because while Krause has been painted as like the bad guy through all of this, none of that happens unless Reinsdorf signs off on it.
True story.
And yep. I think a lot of that from him was probably, cost cutting and saving money. Mm. You don't want to have to pay Scotty and Mike $30 million and pay Dennis $20 million or something like that. I think that they were looking at it saying, maybe we have 1 or 2 years more of this team. Do we want to have, this crazy salary? And, do we want to pay all of these guys what they're going to be worth after they hit this free agency after that season? So there's that. And Scotty, I think when you really dig into his background, being mm-hmm. from a family that big, and seeing what real poverty was like and sort of being in a situation that he never really envisioned himself being in, I could see you sort of wanting to, grab all you can at that moment before, even if we look at him as like this super athlete or whatever, in his mind, he's still the same person that he probably was. At that point, he signed a deal in 91. He's probably still the same person that he was in, 85. He might be looking at this thing as fleeting, I could get one injury and this whole dream will be over. So, if you secure $17 million to take care of your family, I totally understand it. The onus isn't necessarily on ownership to, renegotiate that, but they totally could have.
Right.
There's a whole stint where Mike isn't even on the team. Scotty's your best player in 94, maybe pay him as your best player then to empower him, and help him lead. But they decided not to do that. And I'm sure there were conversations that he had with them about the money before they got to 97, 98. Because in the documentary, they say that contract sort of got old very quickly. And once TV came into it, the money was different.
Absolutely.
So part four kind of gave off that the triangle sort of unlocked Scottie Pippen and was one of the key things that helped bring him to this next all-star level. And today when I was watching the jump, Tracy McGrady said that he didn't think that was primarily responsible for that. He thinks it was more of a natural progression because going into that time, he's heading into his fourth year. Usually your third, fourth year, if you're going to become a star, you kind of figure it out. So being that you guys kind of saw this happen in real time, I mean, what do y'all think? Do y'all think that this was the sort of, was it the triangle offense that really unlocked Scotty? Was it just, his development? Was it both? Like, how did that go at that time?
I'm gonna let
Deontay.
You might
be edging me up a little bit.
I wasn't around at all yet, so
I'm 33, but I did not know what the triangle was in 91. I'm not gonna pretend like
right.
I knew defensive coverages, or I was like writing out plays when I was 6 years old. I'm not gonna pretend that at all. I think it's maybe a little bit of both, because the other part that they covered was Doug Collins having an entire offense where every play led to Michael Jordan finishing with the ball, whereas Phil and the triangle and Tex Winter, it's a little bit more cohesive. And Scotty wasn't necessarily the type of guy who's going to say, give me the ball, I'm going to go get mine. That was never really the way he played. Mm. When you look back, even though he was capable of scoring more, when you look back at stats or whatever, there were a lot of games where he would have 15 points and take 9 shots or something like that. He wasn't necessarily a gunner like that. And I think that he was sort of like more predisposed to be a facilitator and a point guard. And I could see how the progression in terms of you know, going through those Detroit years, learning how to play with Mike, learning from Mike, and then also having this offense that sort of tailors to you at the right time. Like, I think both of those were sort of, you know, like a perfect marriage.
So I happen to agree with Deontay. I think it's a lot of that. And I also felt that the opportunity Deontay talked about before, which is the 93-94 season when Jordan left, and 95, being the man on that team, even though he was crazy underpaid, I remember as a Knicks fan just still how good that team was with Pip leading them. And I think he was second in MVP in 93-94, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, they still made it to the Eastern Conference
Finals. Yeah, still made it to Eastern Conference Finals. And, I mean, yeah. I'm a Knicks fan. I know we got lucky with the Hubert Davis call there, but they kind of owed us the year before.
They were getting at you in this part.
Yeah. So, I think that experience actually took his game to another level. You know, Deontay took him to that really next level where he learned to lead, and he really learned how to play without Mike. And so that did a lot for him there. Did you enjoy seeing, because you said you were like six in 91? You said that?
I was born in 86.
So you were born in 86, right?
Yeah, so I would have been five.
You've been five in that. For you, even though you grew up a Bulls fan and saw some of this team that we're covering in The Last Dance, to see that earlier stuff, right, like especially against the Bad Boys, in that run, in that era, how was it to you to watch that era of the NBA and see that physicality? I'm sure you've watched old stuff, but what's it like to see that time?
So I don't remember really watching these games like that, but as a kid, being, you know, like 9 or 10 or whatever, we had all the VHSs. So I watched, I think it was, I was just watching this again. It was called Unbelievables. So
yeah.
It went through every era, and it showed you literally every title run. So I remember being over a friend's house and popping that in and watching the entire thing. So, like, I remember a lot of this stuff, not from when it actually happened, but from VHS in a more, like, condensed way. But seeing the way that the stuff that they did, I'd have been throwing hands, man. Like, the composure Mike had was crazy. I think Scott Williams, I remember he got slapped on the face by Lambeer. Like, that was the way that I probably would have responded to that. Like, the composure Mike had to know exactly what they're trying to do, to know exactly what the result is going to be if he goes in there and he, you know, tries to go up in the air, and to just do it and take the fall and get up and, you know, go to the free throw line is crazy. And they a lot of people in the doc said it over and over, like, I'm surprised he made it out, I'm surprised he was alive. Like, mm-hmm. he really took some punishment. And that was before he went and bulked up and added muscle or whatever. I would like to know how long those ice baths were after after those games, because he got crushed.
He was taking a beating.
Maybe it was kind of a generational thing, but I saw a lot of people on Twitter actually complaining about that, like, oh, that's not basketball, you can't do that, this and that, where, you know, back then that was kind of what you had to do to stop somebody like this. You know,
the Pistons, I think, were in their own lane in terms of, like, how physical they were. Like, nobody was doing to people what they were doing to people.
No, but at the same time, I even remember playing in parks. If you got flagrant fouled, you kind of just got flagrant fouled. You know, that was part of.
But there's some things like, where Deontay, you know this too from playing ball. If somebody crossed the line, you had.
Oh yeah,
we had to do something. No. You know,
like,
what I mean?
You jump and somebody push you in your back.
Yeah.
There's a line for sure. But I think that the sensibilities of today is that almost anything is a foul. Like, I noted this on Twitter where Michael Jordan was saying that, oh, you know, just keep playing or whatever he said. Just, you know, don't complain or whatever it was. I'm flubbing up what he actually said, but that's essentially that's the message he was trying to get across. When I watch NBA games today, and every single play, there's a complaint over a dead ball. Like, there's a complaint over a call. There's LeBron, Trey Young, Spencer Dinwiddie, everybody, every single play. And it does not stop. And that shit is annoying.
You know what's funny? Well,
even when they blatantly foul people, they go to the ref.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's like every single play where it's like when you actually, like, go back and watch some of these games, there are games where dudes are not really barking at the refs like that.
They don't get at the refs like that, and they were a lot more coachable too. I think the culture is different. Players know that they're in the driver's seat. They know that the coach can be let go. They know that if they get to refs enough, or if they sort of set a tone, you could become what Harden is, where you literally live off free throws.
We don't need any more James Harden.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just saying he lives off free throws. And
no, I know, but Jesus Christ,
he's manipulated everything in a way that really benefits him. Obviously,
are you a James Harden fan?
I think he's super skilled. I don't think he's always fun to watch.
Gotcha.
I think he's the worst star to watch.
When he has it going and he's doing the step backs and he's knocking down shots and he's like on a run, that can be fun. But whenever those plays in the lane don't work and those fouls don't happen, it's just flailing and it can get ugly quick.
Nah.
I do think it's a generational thing, because I don't think a LeBron James that's born into that style of basketball, like if he's a kid in the 80s and then he plays in the 90s, he's probably not the same LeBron where he's complaining after every single call. He's probably a different, you know, he's probably brought up like the way these guys were. So I do think it's a generational gap of feel like they can bark at the refs and stuff like that, and it just continues on and on.
It was frowned upon too, right? Like your teammates, you had a lot of people like Jordan that would be like, yo, don't go and complain to the refs.
Just keep playing.
If anything, you were going to go at the other player. You're going to try to get in that other player's head. You weren't necessarily going to complain to the refs. It was almost a sign of weakness back then to kind of go and complain to the refs.
I'm trying to think. Even when I played, I barely got into it with refs. I used to get into it with other players, but I barely got into it with refs.
I mean,
yeah. That's probably a difference in the NBA too, though. It's not really, you can't really get into it with other players.
That's a good point.
About text quick.
Right.
Mm. So you can't really go.
They should let players get into it with other players more. Yeah, that'd be good for the players.
You know, taunting calls are you could dunk on somebody, look at them too long, and get a tech.
Right.
Like that happens.
Sean can't point it at somebody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And you can't do that now.
Multiple times.
You know what Scotty did to Patrick Ewing? I know.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Thank you, Deontay. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up.
He kneed him in the face and stepped over him on purpose. That would be a tech.
Yep.
Allen Iverson did to Derek Fisher. That would be a tech now too.
Yep.
Oh, Tyronn Lue. Sorry.
Tyronn Lue. Yeah. It would absolutely be a tech. Yep. It absolutely would be. So Deontay,
my cousin did that actually in a pickup game after Iverson did it, and he got a tech.
Oh, really?
Wait, how did he get a tech in a pickup game?
Well, it was, you know, like a rec league game. Not like a school game, but right. Like a rec league game. We had refs, but yeah, he did that. He got a tech when we were like, you know, like 10, 11, something like that.
Damn, that's crazy. So, Deontay, what are you looking forward to in the rest of this series? We've seen a lot in the first four parts. What are you looking forward to for the rest of the series?
So, this was sort of like the climb. I want to see where Jordan goes to make sure that they stay up there. The baseball aspect, sort of like what drove him to that, if you know, how honest he'll be about that.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they already showed his father, and I think they showed him that for a reason, because, you know, in the next couple of episodes, they'll probably highlight the effect that losing his father, you know, might have had on his life. The next week, the preview includes Kobe, so I think they'll probably dig into that All-Star weekend when they went against each other. So there are a lot of good storylines still to get to, for sure.
Mm. Yeah, no, there's definitely a lot.
I want to see Dream Team stuff, and I want to see baseball stuff. That's what I'm
Dream
on.
Team too.
I want to see Dream Team stuff, because I want to see, like, I only know that Isaiah Thomas was kept off the team. I don't really know much more than that.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I wanted to ask Deontay too. Deontay, you know all the rumors that Jordan kept him off the team. After you heard the comments that he had, I believe that was in part four, when he was talking about when the Pistons left the court in 91, didn't shake hands. When I heard Jordan talk about that, you could like really tell he like does
he's
still
upset. Yeah,
he's still pissed.
He's still pissed. Mad. Like, he really still doesn't mess with Isaiah.
Yeah.
When I listened to that, I was like, yo, I think he really kept that dude off the team. Do you think he kept him off the team?
I don't think it was just him, though.
You don't think it was just him? Okay.
Mm. It seemed like, so Isaiah and Magic used to be really close. I think at that time, they might have been on the outs on some level.
Mm.
Because I wrote something about this recently. I did like all the biggest moments in the Pistons-Bulls rivalry. and I end it with Isaiah being left off of the Dream Team. So they put together this team, not in 92, but the summer right after Isaiah and all of those guys did the walk-off.
Mm. Mm.
So that's fresh in everybody's mind when they're putting the team together. So you got the executives and people who don't want to piss off Michael Jordan, who might have had a hand in that too. So I think that when it got to Mike, they already knew that they wanted him so much that, you know, it's like, all right, so what are the things, like, what are the stipulations we think he might have?
Yeah.
And I think they knew that there was this front-facing rivalry with Isaiah and with the Pistons. And I kind of believe him in that it was presented to him as Isaiah wouldn't be on the team because they were trying to appease him. But I think that had they not done that, he would have also been like, yo, I don't want this guy. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because we can tell there's still venom there. He still hates it. As soon as they mentioned Isaiah's name with the walk-off, he just went in. And Isaiah actually, I was just watching this before y'all called. He was on First Take saying that he was surprised that Michael still harbored so much like personal animosity. Not that he expected him to be upset with the team and the way that they can conduct the business or whatever, and like, you know, physically beating him up, as Jordan called it.
Yeah.
But that he personally doesn't like those guys outside of the basketball court. Isaiah said he was surprised that he still felt that strongly about it.
I mean, but did he see his Hall of Fame speech? You know, like,
my guy doesn't let go of grudges.
He don't forget nothing.
I respect it, though. I respect it. So,
he's still mad at his high school coach.
Yeah, there's some things that you got to hold on to. That one, I don't think so. But there's some things that you got to hold on to. I believe that. Oh, speaking of the Dream Team, I actually don't know this, but y'all might know the answer to this. Why was Christian Laettner on that team over Shaq?
No, Shaq was still in college.
So no, was Laettner, no?
They both left.
Oh, they both left that light? Okay.
That was the first year that it turned from amateur to professional.
Yeah.
So I think
that I know, yeah.
Sort of like throw a nod to those guys and just sort of like at least include the best player in college. Laettner was a winner and he had been one of the best players in college for absolutely. Years. It's like, I obviously now, like, it's a little downplayed what he was because his NBA career wasn't necessarily what he was in college, but it wasn't like Shaq would have been a no-brainer to be picked over Laettner at that time.
Yep.
Like, he was more athletic, but he was on an LSU team that wasn't, like they weren't...
But they weren't as good,
Final
yeah.
Four, like, nah. They weren't winning yeah. like that, you know what I mean?
I mean, and I would have just thought... I would have just thought it would have been funny to see him playing against some of those other countries because he's so much bigger than pretty much everyone else that they had.
Yeah. I mean, even back then, though, he wasn't really that much bigger than everybody.
He was just tall. He wasn't as big.
But he was still, you know, like the agile, you know, thinner Shaq. So it was a different player, too.
Yeah, it definitely was. Nah, man, I've been enjoying the series. I'm definitely excited to see how it finishes out and what else we see. As a Bulls fan, how much pride are you taking in seeing this? Because, you know, the Bulls haven't had a lot to cheer about too much lately. But
new GM.
New GM, they got some news. Yeah, you know, we can talk about that with you. Yeah. We'll go into that. They do have the future to look forward to. We can just look at the past and the last dance. But how excited are you about the future with the reshaping of the front office? And what do you think this means for the Bulls going forward?
How much do you think you could get in return for Zach LaVine?
Yeah, how much do you think what?
No, say the question again.
Is that you said?
I said, how much do you think you could get in return for Zach LaVine?
I mean, probably not that much.
That's correct.
It's not that he can't score. It's that, like, no team in the NBA wants him to be their number one scorer. It would take for him to have sort of a different mental approach to the game. And maybe, you know, next year after, you know, if they lose just as much as they did this past year, he'll probably be ready to go and be ready to accept sort of a lesser role on a team that wins. But, you know, he's got his money. So they're definitely making positive strides, I think, in the way that they're handling this front office situation. The one troubling thing is the way that it started. The fact that John Paxson basically had to fire himself Like, and that's why I say, like, Reinsdorf, I think you kind of, even when he's, you know, he's saying things on this documentary, you kind of have to, like, separate fact from fiction with him. The fact that this whole restructuring wouldn't happen unless John Paxson looked around and decided that he wanted something different or that he wanted to take a step back, he would still be there. Gar Forman would still be there. And it's still weird that he's in this advisory role, which I think can cause problems with the team for sure. You know, the Lakers had this issue where I think it was Kurt Rambis was like still in some weird advisory role with the Lakers while Magic was there, and that was causing issues. So the Reinsdorf in general with the Bulls and the White Sox, they're not good at cutting ties with people. So the fact that this has even happened on this level is sort of like a revelation for people in Chicago, I think. So to have a guy who, in Arturas coming in from Denver, who understands analytics, who knows how to scout international, as a guy who's, you know, actually from out there, who played against the Bulls actually in that Paris game that they showed in a documentary. So, and then, and now they just hired the first Black GM in franchise history, which if you look at the candidates that the Reinsdorfs were bringing in, that's that, I don't think that that move is them. I think that's all Arturas. They brought in guys who all had histories, like charted, like, Well, they all had like issues with racism and, you know, saying things that weren't above board.
Right.
You know, they brought in Wilcox, they brought in Danny Ferry. Like, all these guys basically had scandals in their past. And, you know, if that's the lineup that you have, I don't think you're like jumping the gun to go hire a Black GM. I think Arturas was the one who said explicitly, like, that he was going to have a front office that was much bigger than the Bulls previously had, because they had one of the smallest front offices in the league, which is another sign that things weren't being run the way they probably should have, and that he was going to have a staff that was full of people from different backgrounds, different races, everything. So, you know, that I think having him in place, I think, is a positive sign.
Deontay, because you touched on something there. Did it bother you at first the way this whole process started? Because when they kind of were zeroing in on Arturas, there was this outcry from other, you know, Black general managers, front office people around the league, saying like, hey, they didn't even interview one Black candidate for this position, which looked bad, obviously, or any minority candidates. I think it's a good thing that this has happened, you know, going forward, and they went and they got somebody. But do you think this will sort of help the rest of the league and other places looking and saying we got to be more diverse in the way we search and look for people to be in front offices?
I think what will be helpful if people realize sort of what that first process looked like to me was that the fix was kind of in already, and then they just interviewed all of these sort of like throwaway names just so that it looked like whatever. It was almost sort of like and this happens in football, but it happens to the Black candidates where, because they have the Rooney Rule, they interview people with no intention of hiring them. That's what the Bulls did with Ferry and Wilcox and those guys. They were never going to hire those dudes. I think that they had already, especially with how quickly it happened, they had already zeroed in on Arturas. Like, there was a backroom deal already. So I think while things like that are still happening, it's going to be hard for people of color, you know, if any racial background, Black or otherwise, to, you know, make it to be the top, you know what I mean, to be the VP of basketball operations. You just have to have those relationships. And sadly, a lot of that is sort of like, you know, that boys club that, you know, people of color aren't always sort of like welcomed into. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the first thing, recognizing that that's an issue. And then I think you saw a lot of players being vocal about that too. And players really do hold a lot of power. So players, I think, have focused generally on who their coach is. And when players start to care more about who's in the front office and start to sort of like rally for more people of color to be in the front office and to be making decisions about, you know, how their careers are going, then I think that'll have a little bit of impact on what those rooms look like as well. And the other thing is, you know, more ownership, you know, representation, people of color. You know, right now it's only two people, with Ron Adeev and Jordan, and then that's it. So I think that it's definitely got to start from the top, and then it's got to players have to sort of like zero in on that as well.
I agree. I guess last thing before we get out of here, the Bulls coach Boylan, do you think he stays? You know, obviously when you get a new regime in the front office, generally they want a clean house, they want to change, get their own guy in there. Do you think he stays? I know we don't even know when the season's going to be, but do you think he stays whenever the next season will be with the Bulls?
No, I don't see that going. I don't see that lasting too much longer, honestly.
Me neither.
When you have to look at the way that he was brought in to begin with, he was essentially an extension of Gar Foreman and John Paxson. He was somebody who was already on the staff. He was an assistant under Hoiberg. They didn't even interview people. They just made, and this was another problem. They should have been interviewing, you know, coaches of color or coaches who were even coaches who were just, you know, qualified for the job. This dude was he was an assistant on Hoiberg's staff. They made him the interim, and then all of a sudden he was the coach. You know what I mean? There was no search. There was no nothing. And he was sort of, I'm saying this in past tense, I know already, but like a lot of the things that he does are just weird. You know, like, there was that player mutiny where he was trying to force people to
come out after
a loss, and his timeouts are like so ill-timed. This past season, he would call timeouts where the team would be losing by like 15. There's like 10 seconds left, and he'll call a timeout and try to like give them some speech and make it some learning situation. And Zach LaVine got pissed off about it every time. Like, why are you calling? You can literally see him mouthing like, why are you calling a timeout right now? Like, and there was one player where he even called a timeout during a fast break and stopped a layup.
What? Like,
yeah, he called timeout.
Wow.
I think it was DiVincenzo got a layup. Somebody was driving. Mm-hmm. They threw a nice pass, wide open layup. They score, but he get called a timeout, so the points are negated. So I don't think he's going to be a good fit with what they're trying to do in terms of like trying to change the culture and trying to, you know, be more savvy as a team. You know what I mean? You have to be savvy, and you have to be a guy that players actually want to – you have to have a coach who players want to play for if you want to bring people in. And yeah, so I don't see that.
You don't see that lasting too much longer. Yeah. Changes with the Bulls going forward are going to be very interesting. See if they can get back to the top. Are the Bulls going to win a championship before the Knicks?
I would think so.
I knew you were going to say those.
Y'all been waiting since
73. Yeah,
that's a great question. Wow, I'm thinking about that right now.
Y'all
have the two worst Eastern Conference situations right now, I think.
I think y'all have one good player. We have like two.
Who's the next one?
Mitchell Robinson.
Are you down on RJ Barrett?
No, RJ was my.
Oh, RJ was Mitchell your guy.
Robinson. Oh wow.
I'll say two.
Mitchell Robinson's good. I like Mitchell Robinson.
And the Bulls.
But he's not like.
He's not
a foundational guy.
No. We don't have. I'm not sure we have that guy yet. I'm not sure.
But I think when Wendell is healthy, Wendell is good.
Wendell's good. Yeah, I like him.
And what you call?
LaVine?
Markkanen.
I wasn't even saying Markkanen.
Kobe?
Terrible season. I was saying Kobe.
Yeah.
Kobe White.
I like Kobe.
You like Kobe?
Yeah. Okay.
Markkanen.
He got better and better, too. Like
He did.
When you watched the maturation. Yep. In that last month, he was averaging like 25-5.
And the shot selection was better. The shot selection was better.
He was being more aggressive.
Yep.
His shot is crazy when he gets going too.
Yep.
So I think he could be a good, like, not, he won't be a franchise player, but I think if he's like your third or fourth best player, you could still be fine.
I think he has a future as probably like a really good six man with the way he plays. If he's a starter, I don't like. It kind of depends on what's around him, but I could totally see him being like almost Jamal Crawford ish. Put him in for 25 minutes, and he could get you 17.
I mean, that's not a bet.
Your best player has to be a ball handler if he's out there. Your best player has to be a big ball handler.
Yeah.
And then the way like LeBron would always have sort of like a Booby or a Mo Williams, you would have to have a guy like that. And then Kobe could sort of be, you know, he could be that guy. The guy that they find in the corner or something like that.
So, Deontay, you're down on marketing? I know you had a bad season last year. You down on him?
I think his so the reason that I'm not super into him because it's not about skill or ability, it's about his mentality. He's not aggressive enough. I think he needs to work on his handle. Because he has that ability, like athletically he can run, but he has to be in open space. He can't create his anything. Own shot. And because the Bulls don't, like we just said, they don't have a true point guard. If he's not playing with a true point guard, he's not really getting shots like that. You know, I think in the years before, he was the only option. You know, so if Jimmy and those, like Jimmy didn't play a lot, so you had Markkanen out there, he was the only guy who was really like capable of scoring. So everybody was looking for him. But then when you have Zach and he's using 30% of your possessions, and he's dribbling a lot, and Markkanen is just standing there.
Right.
He was taken out of the game, but he also didn't have that mentality to be like, yo, like, chill, like, find me.
Right. He doesn't have that aggressiveness.
I would want to trade that whole roster almost.
He has the skill, but when you get to that level, everybody has skill. Like, we've been seeing this in The Last Dance. It's your mental and how hard you work. That's what's going to separate you from people when you get to that level. It's like the layer that separates people from like average and good and great. It's thin.
Yep.
Oh yeah.
Agree with that. Deontay, man, we want to thank you for coming through as always, talking a little Last Dance, little Bulls with us. And you know, keep up the great work that you're doing at the Trib. I'm happy you're back home. I miss you here in New York, but I'm happy you're back home, man. So
I appreciate it.
Glad you're doing well. For our guest, Deontay Prince, he is the editor, writer, covers a lot of the Bulls Chicago sports at the Chicago Tribune. For my man Brian Fonseca, until next time, y'all. Peace.